Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Milo Nipo to contend, Umbati Bakaja Hufika.
Mais chibango,
dois,
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report, featuring some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. In the second and third hours, we'll do an update, detailed review of developments in West Asia, in Palestine, Lebanon, and other contiguous and neighboring states. Right now, we'd like to take our musical interlude with the music Soon, Egyptian classical music from 1956, broadcast over Radio Cairo. Let's listen in.
سيداتي وسادتي مساء الخير. من مسرح حديقة الأسبكية تقدم لكم الإذاعة المصرية أم كلثوم في أولى حفلاتها لعام 1956. لقد اعتدنا أن نلتقي بأم كلثوم في مطلع كل شهر، والليلة نلتقي بها في مطلع العام لنقضي معها ليلة من لياليها التي تجدد فينا الأمل وتجدد فينا الحب وتملأ قلوبنا بالتفاؤل. التفاؤل بغد أفضل نعمل من أجله وسنصل إليه. امتلأت الآن دار مسرح حديقة الأزبكية بالذين أقبلوا ليحضروا هذا الحفل الساهر الذي تقدمه لهم الإذاعة المصرية وتحييه كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم. ستغني أم كلثوم في مستهل حفلة الليلة أغنية من أغنياتها العاطفية الحلوة، أغنية يلي كان يشجيك أنيني، كلمات أحمد رامي وموسيقى رياض الصنباطي. تسمعون هذه الدقات التقليدية التي تنبأ عن قرب رفع ستار عن كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم في أولى أغنياتها في أولى حفلاتها لعام 1956. ارتفع ستار الآن أيها السادة عن كوكب الشرق السيدة أم كلثوم وسط أعضاء فرقتها الموسيقية لتقدم لنا أولى أغنيات السهرة يلي كان لشقيق أنين.
Thank you. من طول
سيداتي وسادتي، غنت وغنت معها قلوب، كانت حيارى فهداه الغناء إلى اليقين. واستحال ما كان في هذه القلوب من أنين إلى حب وحنين، يؤلف بين قلوبنا جميعا ويربط بينها برباط من المحبة والمودة والوئام. وغنت أم كلثوم في مطلع هذه الحفلة التي تقيمها الإذاعة المصرية في مطلع هذا العام الجديد. وغنت يلي كان تشقيق أنيني، كلمات أحمد رامي وموسيقى رياض السنباطي. سيداتي وسادتي، سوف نلتقي بأم كلثوم مرة ثانية بعد قليل. إلى اللقاء، والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Welcome back, and that was the live concert by Umm Kulthum from 1956, broadcast over Radio Cairo. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast on this Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. In the Palestinian refugee camp of Jabalia, atrocities which are being committed by the Israeli Defense Forces are surfacing through the Electronic Intifada website. According to a latest report, it says this is how residents are describing the situation in Jabalia and northern Gaza as Israel's offensive there nears a second month. Israel has ordered every resident to head south, but has also erected checkpoints preventing people from moving. Out of an estimated 400,000 people in the north, when the assault started in early October, over 100,000 are understood to still remain. Israel has all but cut off humanitarian aid to the territory in an apparent attempt to starve people out. It has bombed with abandon, killing some 1,200 people over the last 4 weeks, including over 100 in a single strike on a house for displaced people in Beit Lahia. That took place on October the 30th, as well as 150 in a series of strikes on 10 buildings in Jabalia on October the 24th. Quote, "You cannot imagine what's happening in Jabalia," unquote, said Nadia El Kafama, 69 years old. Quote, "The sky is black with smoke and the ground is scorched," unquote. Nadia spoke to the Electronic Intifada over the phone, despite an unstable network. The Israeli military had forced her out of her shelter in the Jabalia refugee camp on October the 17th, but she is still in Gaza City in the north. Quote, "Nothing has been spared from destruction. The sounds of explosions are strange, different from before, terrifying and bone-shaking, as if they would tear you apart," unquote, a deeply upset Nadia said. She went on to say, "Inside me, everything is shattered and broken from the horror of what I saw. Even now, my heart is clenched and I am gripped by fear," unquote. "Doomsday," she said, quote, "I have witnessed doomsday horrors," unquote. You can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. and other developments taking place. Formed in 1984, Ayub Mayet and Jeremy Corrida, the Mavericks, began composing music of resistance against apartheid in South Africa. The South African band, Mavericks, recently announced just this last past Sunday the release of their new song, If I Must Die, with music composed by Jeremy Corrida and lyrics by Palestinian poets Mohamed Moussa and Rafat Alarir. Formed in 1984 by Ayub Mayet and Jeremy Corrida, the Mavericks began composing music of resistance against apartheid in South Africa. The band has since provided a platform for young artists, continuing their legacy of solidarity and advocacy through music. For this song, Matab Hayat, a young lecturer, singer, and activist, was invited to feature as the lead vocalist, lending her voice to this powerful tribute. Alarir, a professor, poet, intellectual, and father, was assassinated by Israeli forces on December the 6th of 2023. Just a month prior, he had written If I Must Die, a poignant poem and personal letter to his young daughter, Shima. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In other news, a spokesman for British Prime Minister Starmer formally revealed last month the UK would neither be apologizing for slavery nor paying reparations for the century-long process of exploitation and oppression. Foreign Secretary David Lammy announced that the UK plans to address the legacy of the transatlantic slave trade by strengthening trade ties with African nations. This week, Lammy is visiting Nigeria and South Africa as part of London's efforts to engage with the continent, coming just days after 56 Commonwealth states signed the declarations advocating for a conversation on reparations for slavery. Describing the transatlantic slave trade as horrific and horrendous, Lammy acknowledged the lasting scars it has left when speaking on Monday in Lagos, Nigeria, a former hub of the slave trade. I am the descendants of enslaved people, so I recognize that, Lammy stated. Lammy's parents are Guyanese immigrants in the UK. Officials had transported numerous African and Indian slaves, as well as indentured laborers, into the old South American mainland colony. The foreign secretary told the British Broadcasting Corporation that reparations are, quote, not about the transfer of cash, unquote, particularly given the UK's current cost of living issue. Instead, he claimed that emerging countries may gain from further transfer of British scientific and technological knowledge. And finally, in regard to this segment, Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu said yesterday that he was ordering the immediate release of 29 children facing the death penalty after being arraigned for allegedly participating in protests against the country's worst cost of living crisis in a generation. Under growing pressure from activists, Tinubu also directed an investigation of the law enforcement agents involved in the arrest and prosecution of the minors. Nigeria's Information Minister Mohammed Idris told reporters in the capital of Abuja they are not expected to be released until today through the court order. The children detained since August were among more than 70 people arraigned on Friday on charges of treason, destruction of property, and mutiny after the August protests that shook the country and culminated in security operatives killing some demonstrators and arresting hundreds. Aged between 14 and 17, four of the minors collapsed due to exhaustion when they were brought to the court last week. Most others looked malnourished and lost as they pressed against one another in the dock, the rest sitting on the floor. There have been no news of their detention until their arraignment, which sparked outrage and renewed concerns about the deteriorating human rights in Africa's most populous country. Nigeria's independence anniversary is marked by protests and frustrations over the harsh treatment of the people. With that, we'll conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast, go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Welcome back, and that was the Motown sound via Los Angeles, California, with the legendary Patricia Holloway, and that track was entitled Stolen Hours. Right now, we want to move into an interview with Professor Mohamed Mirandi of the University of Tehran, talking about the latest developments taking place in Iran and in West Asia. Let's listen.
Israeli missile strikes. Any layman like me would be able to see that there is a big difference between the two. So the Israelis failed in Gaza, they failed in Lebanon, they failed against Iran, and they will continue to fail. But the West will empower them to keep the slaughter going. Because as I said, the West is so utterly evil that it will allow the Israelis to obliterate the Palestinian people, and they will continue to support it if it comes to that. But it won't, because the Israeli regime will fail, and it will be unable, it will be forced to end this war at some point. And when it does, it will, the war will end in failure. And that will be a very important turning point for the demise of the regime. And one point that I think is also important is that the objective now for the Israeli regime is to bring in the United States. They want the United States to enter the war, and which is not impossible. The Americans obviously don't want it, but Netanyahu doesn't care about the United States. He doesn't care about India. He doesn't care about any country, because if the Americans come into the war, then the Iranians will have to destroy all American bases in the Persian Gulf. But far more important than the American bases is that those countries that host those bases, they will cease to exist. They are small, weak, vulnerable regimes that do not have the ability to defend themselves. Their oil and gas installations will be gone. So if the Americans start a war, then it's war, because this will be a fight for our survival. And the Iraqi resistance will wipe out the Americans in Iraq and Syria immediately. Immediately. It will be very swift. And that would lead to a global economic collapse that will impact the world for probably decades. Does Israel care? No. Does Netanyahu care? No. He doesn't care about India. He doesn't care about the United States. He doesn't care about Europe. He doesn't care about anyone. They care about themselves. Iran does not want the war to expand, but Iran will retaliate. Why? Because if Iran doesn't retaliate and create deterrence, the regime will just do it again, because the Americans and the Europeans will enable them to do it. They enable them to carry out a Holocaust. You think they won't allow them to carry out another strike on Iran? Of course they will. The West will give them whatever they need. So Iran has to create deterrence. Iran has to slap down Netanyahu because the West won't yank hard on his leash. And so we are in a dangerous situation, because Iran will have to respond, and Iran will strike hard, very hard. And I think these people should take me seriously, because in the past when I said Iran will strike, the last time around they said they won't, but we saw what happened. This time Iran will hit very hard. And what will the Israeli regime do in response? Who knows? What will happen? I don't know. There are different scenarios. But if the Americans get involved, then everything will change. But the Americans won't win. Everyone will lose.
You made the key argument, in fact, key point, I would say, that the escalation in Lebanon and then eventually to Iran is fundamentally born out of Israel's failure to make Gaza unlivable or ethnically cleanse Gaza out of the Palestinians completely. And there are reports now that says that in the immediate wake of October 1, when the ground incursions had started, some of those protesters were protesting against Netanyahu, not because they oppose colonialism, but primarily because of Netanyahu's failure to bring back the hostages. They were much more sympathetic and supportive of the government, of the Zionist regime, because the war had escalated. And I think it is in this light one must understand the Israeli escalation to Lebanon and eventually to Iran. And I think this ties to your second key point, that this is not Israel itself, but the Israeli-American alliance that is after Iran. And even with the recent on Saturday attack, I mean, one U.S. defense official says that it is almost entirely likely that F-35 stealth fighters were used to initially clear the airspace, creating what they call the air corridor through Syria, because they say that the Americans control the Syrian airspace and Iraqi airspace. So it's almost inconceivable to go into Iran without full support of American military, and eventually using even maybe the heavier F-16 and F-15, also the C-2 refueling aircraft. So can you? This is my last point on this. You make this important point that the Iranian preparation for defense and resistance has been not particularly against Israel, which is one piece of it, but actually against the superpower itself in the wake of the invasion after the 9/11 of Afghanistan, of Iraq, and so on. A lot of people, I think, fails to understand the Iranian strengths because they don't understand the context, or maybe there is a lot of amnesia regarding the full American strategy of invading Iran, which they had to back down. Can you give us a little bit of historical context on that?
A couple of things first. One is that, to put it in language that is understandable to the West, before the Israeli attack on Iran, the markets in Iran were down. And anyone can look this up. It's all online. And the Iranian rial depreciated. The stock market was down. The morning after, hours after the so-called attack that the Iranians would not know what hit it, markets went straight up. And to use Western terminology, the markets, you know, you can't hide many things from the markets. Someone can put, I don't know, patriotic music on television and say that we destroyed the enemy and all that, but markets are markets. They're going to look for the facts and to, you know, figure out. The markets saw this as a failure. That's why they went, you know, that's why they went up so much. So to put it in language that is understandable to Western elites and those who are in power, that I think is significant. So it was obvious it was a failure. Second, what I would like to point out is that the F-35 is not a very good plane. And it's, first of all, it's not as stealth as they pretend it to be. And second of all, the payload is very small. It was a failed project, and especially since the Israelis have been using F-35s with the support of the Americans. This was a joint American-Israeli operation. The Americans were part of this aggression against Iran, and they will pay up the price. There are many ways to make the Americans pay a price, and they will pay the price. Remember, they are occupying Iraq and Syria, and Iran has many friends in Iraq, as everyone knows. So, and they're not proxies, they're allies. If, you know, proxies don't win against a much more powerful foe. A proxy doesn't defeat the Israeli regime, which has, as I said, an air bridge from Europe and the United States. They don't win battles despite the other side having all the weapons and bunker busters that they need. And 40 white European countries and Western countries providing them with all the intelligence. Their embassies are involved. Their NGOs are involved in spying. Many of their reporters are involved in spying. Their drones are flying over the Mediterranean to help with the genocide in Gaza and the genocidal strikes in Lebanon. They're giving them political cover. They give them ammunition, weapons. And of course, the Western media tries to whitewash all their crimes. So these are not proxies in Yemen that make the Red Sea unusable for the Israeli regime and its allies. These are not proxies in Gaza, which are standing in defiance well after a year of Holocaust. And these are not proxies in Lebanon, which are humiliating the Israeli regime, who was supposed to take southern Lebanon. They said, we destroyed the leadership. And now it will be a piece of cake. They've been humiliated. So these are not proxies. But in any case, these allies will be able to punish the Americans as they are punishing the Israeli regime. But I think it's important to note that the weapons that the Israelis use, now that they've used them, and the planes that they've used, and the operation that they carried out, a lot of information has been gathered as a result. And the Russians and the Chinese will be very happy to learn about what sort of information has been gathered. And so basically what the Israelis have done is that they've created an opportunity for Iran, Russia, and China to better understand U.S. capabilities. So the Israeli regime, by carrying out this operation, have imposed a huge cost for the entire U.S. military. That's a key point.
A very quick, go ahead.
Yes, but historically, the United States, after invading Iraq and Afghanistan, they had effectively surrounded Iran. Remember, back then, Russia was a weak country. China was still growing. The U.S. was able to bully these countries into accepting sanctions against Iran at the U.N. The Russians and the Chinese would water them down as much as possible, but they were weak.
The heydays of unipolar world.
Yes, exactly. The hyperpower. So the United States was at the height of its power back then. It was a different world from today for your younger viewers. And it was not such a long time ago. I was your age, but it seems like it was 100 years ago. So the United States was immensely powerful. They invaded Iraq. They invaded Afghanistan. They surrounded Iran. They were in the Persian Gulf. These regimes in the Persian Gulf are basically, you know, in they'll do what the Americans want them to do. Every single one of them. Maybe like some of them would be a bit different, but not that much. They won't stand up to the United States by any means. So, and one senior American official said, real men go to Tehran, meaning that, you know, the objective is to take Tehran. So Iran began to prepare itself back then. And the United States didn't invade Iran. They never even bombed Iran. Why? Because even back then, when Iran was much weaker than it is today, because remember, Iran had just ended a war with Saddam Hussein in 1988, a war where the Americans and the Europeans helped impose. They gave Saddam chemical weapons to use against Iranians. The civilized world was giving him all these banned weapons to use against Iranians. I was gassed twice. You know, when they talk about World War II and gas chambers, and then I was gassed by German chemical weapons, you know, for me, people like me and people who survived in Iran, when the West talks about human rights, it's always been obvious that it's all nonsense. It's all show. They're the greatest violators of human rights on this planet. But part of the reason why, and this is something that I missed earlier, I'm sorry for my disorganized discussion, part of the reason why people believe that the Israelis are strong is because we are Orientalized Orientals. We still believe what the West tells us. And this is something that I've seen in mainstream Indian media, that if the Reuters says it, if AP says it, if CNN says it, if the Washington Post says it, if the Guardian says it, then it must be true. And my experience has been that it's most probably not true. And if it is true, it is twisted. And history has, you know, history, I think, shows it. But people have short memories, or they don't go back for accountability. They don't look back. So, okay, so Iran has been defeated here, so we have no more air defenses. We have no more missile capabilities. So we should, during the next exchange, Iran will not strike Israel hard anymore, because Iran won't have the ability to fire off that many missiles anymore. But when that happens, no one is going to go back and say, oh, so the Israelis were lying. Western media was lying. This was just propaganda. This was a part of the propaganda campaign. No, they'll go on to the next lie. And they'll believe that, and they will go on. That is because our minds have been colonized for hundreds of years. We've gained independence as countries. India is an independent country. Iran is an independent country. But many of us are intellectually, we are still colonized. So they continue to be an authority. Even when we oppose them, we'll believe them, or give them more credit than that which they deserve. But time will tell. And the world is changing much more rapidly than people in the West think. Not just the BRICS summit. There's so many things happening in Ukraine, elsewhere, that I think it's going to dawn upon people that the West is sort of like the Wizard of Oz. It's not nearly as powerful as it thinks it is. And but you know, I'm fine with the phrase "time will tell."
I like your phrase "Orientalists." So it's not what Edward Said said, that how the colonialists represented us, but it's also us buying their narrative. So it's perhaps Said did not emphasize as much, but we understand that being from this part of the world.
Yes, or Malcolm X would call it the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro being the slave that is more compliant, who has interest in being with the master, and the slave Negro, or the field Negro, is the person who's being brutalized the most and who hates the master. You know, so we have, the comprador class. There are many terms for it, that the brown sahib, the person who mimics or tries to imitate. You know, they love to read Western books and Western novels. They prioritize them over local culture, and the different parts. The different people have used different terms to orientalize. Oriental is basically those of us who we are the non-Westerners, but we are orientalized. We are orientalists ourselves. We believe their worldview. We try to be like them. We try to look more civilized to them, but in their eyes. As I said, the world is changing, and this is not going to continue for much longer, simply because the facts on the ground are going to make the world a very different place in the near future. Things are changing much more rapidly than anyone ever imagined. The perpetual wars, the never-ending wars, the stupidity of liberal capitalism, but also the war in Ukraine and the genocide in Gaza. The West in Gaza has exposed itself as being inhumane and barbaric. And the West is now being increasingly, they're a police state. Young people in Australia, young people in Canada and elsewhere, they're intimidated. Shop owner, anyone who wants to protest against Israel is intimidated. They feel threatened that they'll lose their jobs, that they'll get into trouble. It's evident. It's clear that the world is changing, and it's clear to people across the world what the West really is all about. The genocide is not something that will go away. It will be a very dark stain on the West for many decades to come, because this is the first genocide that has been carried out live in front of a global audience, and they will not stop it, despite the fact that we see it when we get up in the morning. And when we see it again, when we want to go to bed at night, and it irritates us. Even though big tech censors, it uses its algorithms, downplay what goes on. Even though many are banned, but still, people, it's so horrible and horrific and overwhelming that people still see it. And I think this has dealt a devastating blow. So the Western economy has gone downhill. The Western military has gone downhill. Their military in Ukraine has failed. All their capabilities have failed to deter the Russians. In Gaza, the same is true, but more importantly, and in Lebanon, their military has failed, and in Iran. But more importantly, the image of the Israeli regime and the collective West that stands behind the Holocaust has been totally demolished. And that, I think, all of these have quickened the pace of the demise of the Western Empire.
I remember your interview at The Wire, and I mean the recent interview, I think you did too, but the recent interview where the host was reading Western sources uncritically, and We noticed the irritation. We felt that because on one hand, you wanted to be in solidarity, given this is not the Western press. But on the other hand, you could also see through that these are Western narratives being read out uncritically and directly. I want to come to what you referred to as these regimes going with the Americans. I think you were referring to Saudi Arabia and UAE and other Gulf allies, probably not Qatar, I suppose, who has a much more complicated position within the geopolitics of the region. I was reading the news, and both UAE and Saudi Arabia condemned the Israeli attack, the Saturday attack on Iran. They have also been put in a hard place by the genocide in Gaza. And earlier we saw some sort of diplomatic opening between Saudi Arabia and Iran under the negotiating leadership of China. How do you look at the geopolitics of the region, and has it improved or is it going downhill?
It's very complicated. The U.S. is using its radar bases in Turkey, in Qatar, in Bahrain, and across the Persian Gulf against Iran. In the Israeli operation, these bases were used during Iranian retaliations. And remember, these are all the Israelis don't retaliate. It's the Iranians who retaliate. The Israelis and the Americans began aggression against Iran many decades ago. The first cyber attack against a country ever was carried out by the Americans and the Israelis against Iran. This was a couple of decades ago. Then they began to murder Iranian scientists. One of them was a colleague of mine at the University of Tehran. He was murdered in front of his wife. Then they murdered a number of Iranian officers that were fighting against ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And this is something that Indians really don't know, by and large, that these groups, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, these extremist Muslim groups that somehow many in India seem to associate with Muslims, these are groups that were created by the Israelis and the Americans and their allies. These are Western assets, and some of them have been transferred to Afghanistan now. And people in India don't recognize it, or many people don't recognize that what they're attributing to Islam is actually, it should be attributed to the Israelis and the Americans who are creating this menace, who have created this menace. But in any case, the Iranians were fighting against ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups in Syria that were funded by NATO and their regional allies, and the Israelis would bomb Iranian officers and kill them. But the Iranian retaliation only began after the Israeli regime bombed the embassy in Damascus, and the West supported the Israelis at the UN Security Council. And then, again, the Israelis murdered and martyred Ismail Haniyeh when he came to Tehran. He was the official guest of Iran. He came for the president-elect's, the then-president-elect's inauguration ceremony, and he was murdered in an official guest house. So Iran retaliated again. So the Israeli strike on Iran was not a retaliation. It was another act of aggression. And the Iranians will be forced to retaliate. So I think that, you know, this is a key point, that the West supports aggression. The West is using its capabilities to help aggression, and countries in the region have been a part of this. The Incirlik Air Base in Turkey is being used against Iran and to help Israel. There's no doubt about that. The Turkish government is continuing to allow oil from the Republic of Azerbaijan, from Baku, to go to Israel, cheap oil. So their trade, although officially banned, they allow it to go through third parties like Greece to Israel and vice versa. Countries in the Persian Gulf, those that have established ties with the Israeli regime, continue to have ties with them. And others have trade. They, you know, the trade goes through Jordan and through other countries. into Jordan. So, but what Iran wants to do is to improve relations with neighboring countries and to draw them away as much as possible from the West, even if that's a small shift. The shift is still a shift. Iran wants peace in the Persian Gulf because peace in the Persian Gulf means better lives for Iranians. It means better lives for Saudis. It means better lives for the people of Kuwait and Iraq, and it means better lives for the people of India. But the Israelis and the Americans are pushing things in the other direction. So the Israeli regime is putting the Indian economy at grave risk. But they don't care, as I said, because they only care about their own colony and crushing Palestinians. So what Iran wants, what these family dictatorships in the Persian Gulf want, is peace. Because they know that in any confrontation with Iran, if they side with the Americans, or if the Americans strike Iran with all the bases and installations that they have, their regimes will be gone. All of them. They're all very weak and vulnerable regimes. So they're in a tough place, but they don't have the sort of independence that India has. You know, Saudi Arabia is not India. The Emirates is not India. They are very dependent on the West. So if the West pushes, what can they do? They'll just pack their bags and move to their palaces in North America. Although if the global economy collapses, you know, even the rich will be affected tremendously. No one is going to go unscathed. It's, you know, it will be something that is really beyond our imagination. The implications in each country, in each part of the world, how many tens, if not hundreds of millions of people will be on the move. God forbid we see such a day. But the government and these Arab family regimes in the Persian Gulf region, if the Israelis force the Americans to do something, they will be gone. And these, you know, their leaders will have left their private jet, these countries in their private jets before the first missile strikes.
That reminds me of how as people from the post-colonial world, we read history of decolonization and how settlers would scramble to move back once colonization collapses. You also mentioned chemical weapon and cyber attack throughout the 1980s, Saddam Hussein and backed by the West. We must also mention that white phosphorus is being used constantly, particularly in Lebanon now, against not just Lebanese, but also UNIFIL.
That's right.
And peacekeeping troops. Not to also mention the cyber attacks, which are basically a violation of all kinds of international law. I appreciate your time, but if you permit, I actually have two more questions. So very quickly, we have talked enough about the West, but just sum this segment up by saying, where do you look at Iran-West relationship at this moment? I'm asking this particularly because you were part of the media team for the Iranian nuclear negotiating team. And back in the days, we used to think that this might be a silver lining, a normalization of relationship, which was, as I understood back then, was lifting up economic sanctions on Iran in exchange of some limits on its nuclear enhancement and allowing of international scrutiny. Of course, Trump came and sabotaged the deal. Where do you look at Iran-West relationship heading by and large at this moment?
Well, actually, I would say that Obama sabotaged the deal in a way in which is even more significant than what Trump did. Because Obama from day one violated the deal, and he did it systematically and intentionally. So Iran abided by its commitments, and the United States didn't. In fact, in 2015, I was also with the negotiating team as their media advisor. And I told Dr. Zarif on the very day that the deal was signed, when he asked me my opinion, I said, I don't think the Americans are going to abide by their commitments.
I remember two different fact sheets that came out after.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. For me, it was a bitter day because I did not, because remember, I was not a part of the negotiating team. Dr. Zarif wanted me to be on the team. I did not want to be on the team for my own personal reasons. I thought maybe they were going to give too many concessions, and I didn't want to be, you know, if I don't agree, then the team will have internal strife, and it's not going to help because I wouldn't be a dominant voice. So I just said, I'll come and help you with media. They also asked me, he asked me to be the spokesman for the team. I also said no, because I said a spokesman can't say anything. But if I'm just your media advisor, I can say what I like. And if I say something that hurts your negotiations, you can just say that, well, he's given his own opinion. He's not our official spokesman. So, but what Obama did, and the reason why I didn't believe that the Americans would abide by their commitments is because Americans consider themselves to be above the law. They're exceptional. When you're exceptional, you can do what you want. Just like Israel. When they're the chosen people, that means Indians are subordinate. That means Arabs are subordinate. That means Iranians are subordinate. That means everyone is subordinate. And when you're subordinate, your life has no value or little value. Your property has little value. The same concept applies for Eurocentrism. The same concept, it is the same thing when you have American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism doesn't just mean that we're better. It means we have more privileges and rights. So when I sign a deal with you, you abide by your commitments and I abide by mine. But when I sign a deal with Americans, I abide my commitment. They say, well, and on this particular case, you know, we will not do this, that you have to abide by your commitments, but we will not be fulfilling our side of the bargain. We have our reasons. And that's the end of the story. And the Europeans will say, well, yes, you know, that's how it is. So I was skeptical. I was hoping it would work, but I was highly skeptical. And unfortunately, it turned out that I was right. And that under Obama, they violated the deal. It was never implemented. Well, small bits and pieces were, but by and large, the Americans did not fulfill their side of the bargain, and they continued to expand the sanctions regime. And I think that that is the story of the United States, whether it's the Minsk Accords, whether it's the ceasefire negotiations over Gaza, the Americans are always lying. Remember, the Americans put forward a plan, and then they said the Israelis, this is the Israeli plan, and they agree. And the Israelis were saying, no, we don't accept it. And Hamas was saying, we accept by and large. And the Americans kept saying, Hamas doesn't accept it, the Israelis are on board. When we knew they were lying, I mean, it was like right in front of you. But the Americans are utterly dishonest, and the Western media is completely compliant. Otherwise, they would say, well, you know, they would be screaming that the Israelis are blocking the ceasefire. But they won't do that. They may say a few things here and there, but the Western media will, the broader narrative will completely be in line with Israeli demands, or whether it's Netanyahu or someone else. Doesn't matter. As I said, they will stick by Netanyahu until the last Palestinian child. Have no doubt about it. Have no doubt about it. This can go on. This Holocaust can go on for 4 or 5 years until everyone is dead. And they will continue to use the same language in the BBC. They will continue to use the same language on CNN and elsewhere and blame the victims. No doubt about it. And they will always say, you know, October the 7th. And they will still repeat the lies if they could about October the 7th. And of course, the history of Palestine is irrelevant. You know, the world began, God created the world on October the 7th. You know, that sort of mentality. So, yes, you're saying.
sorry, no. You spoke about Americans and Israelis sabotaging a negotiation. I remember Hamas, I think it was in March, accepting the proposal, immediate ceasefire, deoccupation of the occupied territories, prisoners exchange, and then the next day, Israel bombs Damascus. And then there was one more occasion. Next day, they kill Ismail Haniya.
Yeah, so the Israelis will, they will sabotage, and then the Americans will blame Hamas. So the problem is that the Americans are utterly dishonest at the negotiating table, And they do the same with Chinese. The Chinese say that they say something at the negotiating table, they agree on something, and then they don't implement it. And then they are arrogant. They say, you know, they blame you. So with regards to the nuclear deal, the Americans lied. When Trump lost the election in 2000, the Americans were saying that Biden is going to sign the presidential decrees and remove the sanctions that were imposed on Iran by Trump so that he can revive the deal. Back then I said to, I think it was at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, there was a online session, you know, I think maybe Chatham House rules, but anyway, I said there were two sessions, but I said on both occasions, both before he came into office and afterwards, that he's not going to do that. And it's interesting that these people, I think it was the IISS, these people were close to the Democratic Party, and they were saying, yes, he's going to do this. And I knew he wasn't going to do it, because that's how the Americans are. They don't abide by commitments. They use everything as leverage. And whenever you show goodwill, they see it as a sign of weakness. They don't see it as a sign of goodwill. So whenever Iran shows goodwill, and it has done so many times, from the 1980s till now, after the war, the Iranians gave the Conoco oil company, an oil field in the Persian Gulf. They negotiated for two years. And Mr. Rafsanjani, who was then the president, said this was a green light to the Americans. I think he used that term. What happened? Congress slapped sanctions on Iran oil and gas sector. And the story goes on. I mean, I can give you many examples where the Iranians actually showed goodwill and the Americans showed greater hostility in return. So while I would like to see a deal where the Americans respect their side of the bargain, I am not optimistic at the moment, because the Americans are a part of this genocide. They're part of this Holocaust. So are the Europeans. They're part of the aggression against Iran. The Europeans have banned Iranian airlines from going to Europe just recently. Those airlines are not really important for passengers, but they are a lot of the medicines that are imported, or the supplies to produce medicines in Iran, come through those planes. The Europeans know that. What they were targeting was Iran's medical supplies through those sanctions. The Iranians recognize that. They recognize what the West does. So, and of course, they monitor the Minsk Accords. They monitor the ceasefire negotiations. It's very difficult to envisage under these circumstances any deal with the West, especially when the Israeli regime is making such threats. When the Israeli regime is making such threats, then is having a nuclear deal really a smart thing to do under these circumstances? So, you know, I'm not optimistic at the moment, but I am in general optimistic because the world is changing. BRICS, I think, was a big event. Not that during the summit everything changes, but it is, I think, symbolic of the changes that are taking place. I think that the partial rapprochement between China and India is very important and very welcome news. So I think the West can continue to slaughter and massacre and oppress, but its days as an oppressive empire are numbered.
I want to leave you with a final question. And this is moving away a little bit from what we have been discussing and asking you a larger question on the Iranian Revolution. Obviously, it's unjust to bring Iranian Revolution towards the end and to ask you a 5-minute question, given it was such a historic moment. Professor Fuad Azadeh last time came here and he spoke about some of the socialist welfare measures that Iran still has and emerged out of those socialistic days of the Iranian Revolution. I wanted to ask you, from someone from the Global South, and this has nothing to do with the West, about those protests that had happened after Mahsa Amini's death. And I want to ask you, because when I read the literature on Iranian Revolution, it is so extensive about how the revolution led to expansion of freedom of women, because a large numbers of women participate in so many organs of civil societies, and even Khomeini himself came and spoke about them and spoke to them, and that led to massive participation of women in different aspects of Iran, including universities, where we know that Iranian women are very well represented. And yet, we heard a year ago or a couple of years ago that the revolution failed in some of these early objectives, and they failed to move forward, which means that newer generation, which are perhaps culturally not aligned with some of the old ideas of the revolution, and the state didn't meet it. I know it's a complicated topic, but if you can sum this great fascinating discussion by what your thoughts are on what happened in Iran internally.
Yes, the revolution was about social justice. It was also anti-colonial and anti-imperial. So, for example, from before the revolution, the revolutionaries and the leaders of the revolution, of the Islamic revolution, they were discussing South Africa, and they were against the Shah for his policies in support of apartheid South Africa and in support of the Israeli regime. And they were opposed to U.S. domination over Iran. And as you rightly point out, most young people in Iran didn't go to school, even though Iran was exporting 6 million barrels of oil a day. Most small towns and almost all villages didn't even have schools. The majority of young people didn't go to school, and women even worse than girls. They were worse off than boys. Immediately in the 1980s, despite the war that the West imposed upon Iran, Iran went towards universal education, and then they expanded universities. My boss at the University of Tehran, the dean of my faculty, is a woman, and during the 21, 22 years that I've been a professor at the University of Tehran, 18 out of those 21 years, 22 years, the dean was a woman. And sometimes the head of my department would be a woman. So my boss would be a woman and the boss of my boss would be a woman. In my department, and here again, I may be not completely accurate, I'm in two departments. I'm an affiliate in one and I'm a member of another. In one department, the last four people, like if I'm not mistaken, in American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies, the last four people who were hired in the American Studies department were women. And in my department at the University of Tehran, the majority of the people who were hired over the recent years, if I'm not mistaken, are women. Because I have to think about it. It's a larger department and we're two parts. But anyway, the majority of the people who've been hired are women. And I think it's very clear that women in Iran under the revolution are much more empowered. Now, there are two things. Iran has its own definition of indecent exposure based upon its religious and cultural values. Well, you know, how far should those laws go? That's debatable. How should those laws be implemented? That's debatable. But Iran's criteria for indecent exposure is different from the West. And just like in other issues, I don't see, I have my own views on Iranian laws and implementation, but I don't see why by any means Iran has to abide by Western standards on anything, unless they make sense to Iranians. Because Iranian laws on indecent exposure are not to put women in boxes. They are, in this worldview, whether one agrees with it or not, they are opposed to the commodification of women, the objectification of women, and the sexualization of women. Now, someone may say, well, I don't agree with how it's done, but that's the objective. Otherwise, women, we have women pilots. We have women taxi drivers. We have women in the armed forces. We have women in intelligence. But I digress. What happened a couple of years ago with Mahsa Amini? And I want to cough. And I keep thinking this is about to end the interview. So sorry if my voice is, I'm trying not to cough. So, sorry. I caught a cold or something. So for a couple of years ago, what really happened during the protests and riots on Mahsa Amini was that Mahsa Amini passed away, and immediately the Persian language media broadcast from the West, BBC Persian, VOA Persian, all these other media channels. There are more anti-Iranian media channels than there outside Iran than there are media channels inside Iran. It's a huge industry. The West has a huge amount of money. And the reason is because in the past, they didn't really focus on China or Russia. All the focus was on Iran. Only more recently are they refocusing on China. So they have this huge anti-Iranian media apparatus and terror organizations and all sorts of things that they've been working on for decades, largely under Israeli influence. So they were saying that this woman was tortured and beaten to death. And so immediately there were protests and riots. But there was never any evidence. And the footage that later came out didn't indicate that she was beaten. In fact, it really shows the opposite, that nothing happened to her. But the riots had already started. The autopsy also didn't show anything. Secret footage taken of her father indicated that she had a major operation when she was a child. But all that aside, the real issue was not Mahsa Amini. It was not about the late young woman, the late Mahsa Amini. It was about a younger generation, as you rightly pointed out, that, and this was post-corona, that was, and Iran has its problems. That's what the sanctions are for. The sanctions in Venezuela and Iran are to make life difficult, to turn people against the state, whether it's Cuba or Iran, that's, or Syria or Venezuela, or, you know, that's the model. So many of them saw many of these young people who were under this influence of this Persian media and who saw the problems at home. And Iran is a normal country. You have corruption, you have incompetence, you have everything, good and bad. They saw Iran as the problem. They concluded that, look, you're the troublemakers. Because they're young, most of these people were between the ages of 15 and 20, 21. They were not like me. They did not live through chemical weapons or anything like that. They were saying, many of them, and some of them were my own young students at my faculty, they were saying that the West wants peace, friendship, and stability, and you have a grudge, and you want conflict, and you want hostility, and you are the troublemakers, and we want to live our lives. That was basically to a large degree, that's what this was about. That these young people saw Iran as the problem and not the West. The West was, you know, democratic. They spoke, you know, for them, human rights was important. Women's rights, children's rights, animals' rights, all sorts of rights, everything. You know, they were just good, and we were bad. Regardless of how true or false that is, and of course I consider that to be an incorrect assessment, what happened in Gaza has changed things dramatically. Not that all these young students are suddenly revolutionaries or anything like that, but this image of the West, not just in Iran, across the world, as I was saying early on in our discussion, has been demolished. This is the West will do anything to anyone. They're willing to do anything. If they're willing to do this to the Palestinian people, they're willing to do it to the Indian people, to the Iranian people, to anyone if it serves their interests. And of course, we know that from the history of colonization, that is what they've done. What they're doing in Gaza is not new. They've done, you know, in numbers, they've done far worse to India. But the difference between Gaza and India is that this is being done in front of our eyes. What happened, and this also, by the way, people across the world, especially in the global south, or as some say, the global majority, when they look at what's happening in Gaza, they see their own history being repeated. So, when I was at school or you're at school, or maybe you and I are perhaps a bit different because we're interested in these areas, but when kids go to school, they read a couple of pages about India's history, Iran's history, or what the British did, or in Iran, what the British did in India, or what the Russians did, or what the Americans did. But it's just a few pages and you move on. And it's not really your focus because you need to learn math and biology and whatever. You either want to become an engineer or you want to, you know, or a physician. So most people are not even interested in that. So it's, you know, people like ourselves, we're more, you know, a minority. Many of us, we read the Western textbooks. We don't read our sources. But in any case, what happened in Gaza suddenly revived everything for everyone across the world. And the same is true with these young Iranians. I've had young students come up to me over the past few months, say, I was completely wrong. And even one student, just after I went to Lebanon, because I stayed in Lebanon for a few days, that student came up and was very kind to me and saying, that student didn't like me a year ago, saying that how worried he was about me in Lebanon, and then he said, how do I make up for what I did before? And I said, just study hard and don't be fooled by the Americans. What else can you do? Just don't be fooled by their narratives in future. The West has destroyed its image. So Iran has many flaws. India has many flaws. Pakistan has many flaws. Kazakhstan has many flaws. All countries have flaws. But what I would say as a final note to your viewers is that if one is fair and objective, what is happening in Gaza is a horrific crime. It is the worst crime in human history because it's being carried out in front of our eyes. We're watching it happen. The country that is standing up to the West and saying that we will not allow you to wipe out the Palestinian people as the Iranians. It is Iran. It is the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies. So it is Iran against this massive coalition in the West. Morally speaking, who's on the right side and who's on the wrong side? And where does the Western media stand in all this? So if you look at this current situation, then I think it's fair to say that people should question everything they've heard about Iran over the past 40 some years that comes from the West. There are very few good books on Iran. Actually, there's one pretty good book that I can mention called Going to Tehran by Flint and Hillary Leverett, who both worked in the White House. But other than that, there may be a couple of others, but I don't recall anything in particular that I don't agree with everything in their book, but I think it's a very good book. If someone wants to learn about Iran, that's a good book to read. But most of the books on Iran are just like what you see in the Western media. They're one-sided, hostile, irrational, and they're wrong. For 40-some years, they've been saying Iran is about to implode, Iran is falling apart, Iran is evil, it's corrupt. And then on the other hand, they're saying that Iran is a growing menace, a threat to the world. How can you be both at the same time? If you're falling apart and you're incompetent and you're evil and everyone hates you and the people want to revolt and you're collapsing because of corruption and incompetence, how can you be a growing menace and a threat to the whole world? It doesn't make sense, but Western narratives don't. It's all a part of this Orientalism. It's this latent knowledge that has been built and which is inconsistent often, but because that knowledge is so powerful, the inconsistencies in the narrative are not easily visible to ordinary people. So you can be both a growing menace and collapsing regime at the same time, and people will nod their heads because that latent Orientalism makes this inconsistent and paradoxical description seem consistent, reasonable, and logical. So I would call on people to rethink Iran based upon who's doing what in Gaza.
Welcome back. And that was an interview with Professor Mohammed Mirandi, who is a professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran in the Islamic Republic of Iran, discussing some of the developments that have been occurring in Palestine, Lebanon, and other areas of West Asia over the last period. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a special worldwide radio broadcast for this Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break and we'll be back with our concluding segment for the Pan-African Journal for this week. Welcome back. That was the music of Minnie Riperton from her first album entitled Come to My Garden. That track was called A Rainy Day in Centerville. This is the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Our concluding segment features a press conference by the United Nations Rapporteur for Palestine discussing the genocide as it unfolds continually inside of Gaza. Let's listen in to this report from the United Nations.
Hello. Good afternoon. And welcome to yet another press conference. You had a difficult day today, but I think this is the last one. So we have with us Ms. Francesca Albanese, Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Ms. Albanese was appointed by the Human Rights Council as independent expert in May of 2022. So we'll first ask her to tell us a little bit about her work and the report, and then there'll be time for questions. So, Vanessa, over to you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I just presented my fifth report, third to the General Assembly, which has a very harrowing title, Genocide as Colonial Erasure. And as I say in the first lines of the report, this is something that walks on the heels of my previous report, which I presented to the Human Rights Council in March this year, where I concluded that based on my findings over 5 months of investigation, there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel had committed acts of genocide in Gaza. And I've continued to investigate what has happened in Gaza, but also the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory after presenting that report. I can say that for over 1 year, I've pleaded to all concerned parties, particularly those states who can exert more influence on the state of Israel to take concrete actions to stop the destruction of Gaza, the destruction of the Palestinian people, to ensure the prompt and unconditional release of all hostages, both Israelis and Palestinians, and to ensure international law is respected. And had international law been respected, at least in the last 12 months, this would have stopped. It should have stopped. It should have been stopped by the Security Council last October. It should have been stopped after the first set of provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. It should have stopped when I presented my first report. It should have stopped before Rafah was invaded or before the invasion of Lebanon. And instead, the silence, or worse, the justification of a small but influential number of states has continued to enable and to nurture the hubris that leads Israeli conduct as we speak. The developments on the ground are gruesome, and since the beginning, the violence, the genocidal violence that I have described in my first report has expanded and metastasized in other parts of the occupied Palestinian territory. And if you look at the patterns of violence, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, roads, energy grids, water pipelines and reservoir homes, and if you look at the numbers of extrajudicial killings in the West Bank as well, on top of the 42,000 Palestinians have been killed, ascertained killed in Gaza, including 17,000 children. How do you explain the over 700 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank, including 170 children? And how do we explain the fact that the Palestinians from the West Bank have been exposed to the same practices and abuses, often rape, among other forms of torture, than those in Gaza, if there was no Hamas military action or presence in the West Bank? Not that the first justified what Israel has done in Gaza. But again, not only we see the past reproducing itself in the occupied Palestinian territory, we see the same indifference, the same ability to look away of many member states in the international community, and we see a total collapse of the international order, which is premised upon the never again that was promised after the Second World War, and in particular after the Holocaust and the genocide, mostly Jewish people. I'm very happy to take your questions. I don't know what else to say other than it's not been an easy year, because surely it has been reluctantly that I took on the functions of chronicler of a genocide, and it's extremely disturbing to see member states pontificating and questioning and obscuring the meaning of international law and dehumanizing the victims of this last 12 months. But however, should you have any questions, I'm here. Yeah, you do.
Okay. Abdelhamid.
Thank you so much. My name is Abdelhamid Sayam from the Arabic Daily Al-Quds Al-Arabi. Thank you for coming again to talk to us. I have a few questions. First, you have been personally attacked, as always the case when someone criticizes Israel, then they try to attack that person personally, like Graham Boole with UNRWA, Lazzarini, now Karim Khan, many others. So how do you take these personal attacks on you? And the second, as you know, international law allows people under occupation and foreign domination to resist. I mean, they become heroes. I mean, we have a statue of Mandela here, and because he was resisting apartheid. Many of the great leaders of modern time were at one stage fighting colonialism. Why only when the Palestinians fight occupation, they are labeled as terrorists? Thank you.
To be very clear, I don't think that Israel is the only state that attacks special rapporteurs. Special rapporteurs get attacked when they scrutinize the human rights records of member states. And there are states who are more vociferous and virulent than others. What is striking in the case of Israel is that there is a cohort of states who echoes and reverberates what Israel says and does. And there is an army of minions at work to produce literally fabrications that have one and only one objective, to distract the attention from where it should stay. So I will not entertain any discussion about how I take these attacks, because they're not just against me, they have been against the special rapporteurs on the occupied Palestinian territory who preceded me, and this year in particular the Secretary General has been vilified and even declared persona non grata, welcome to the club, and so the General Assembly. What is more shocking to me is that this year the United Nations have been under an unprecedented military attack. 70% of UNRWA premises have been hit by Israeli fire, and which has also hit peacekeepers in Lebanon. And the United Nations humanitarian functions have been hampered at the moment where they were the only bulwark to continue to provide assistance to the Palestinians in an extreme situation of distress. And it's because of that that I do believe that while Israel is by no means the only state that violates international law, and it's not even the only state that violates the right of self-determination of a people, but it's surely unique in the determination, the protractedness of this conduct, and the fact that Israel has never faced any consequences. And indeed, I do believe that the impunity that has been granted to Israel has allowed it to become a serial violator of international law, which is the reason why I recommended that this is the time, as it has been for apartheid South Africa, to consider, for the General Assembly to consider the suspension, I mean recommending the revision or the suspension of Israel's credentials as a member of the United Nations until it ends violating international law, until it withdraws the occupation, which is clearly unlawful also by determination of the International Court of Justice, and surely until it continues its genocidal attack on the Palestinians.
You and then Mike.
Hi, my name is Ibsam Azim, Al Arab Al Jadid newspaper. Good to see you again. I have two follow-ups. First, on the issue of suspension of Israeli membership or to the UN, if you could elaborate on that and whether you believe this is something that will get a majority in the General Assembly. My other question is regarding third parties' role in the war that's going on, whether it has to do with delivering weapons. I mean, their responsibility when it comes to international law and the lack of them taking any steps and basically supporting. So the accountability for not only for Israel but also for third parties. And the last thing, in your remarks today to the committee, you talked about the lack of empathy that you are seeing by some member states in not even expressing any empathy for the Palestinian victims. And also the issue of the many states talking about human rights in academic context or theoretical context, but when it comes to the issue of Palestinian human rights, they are even attacking students, they're not allowing or attacking people who demonstrate against the war. If you could also touch on that. Thank you so much.
First of all, I should briefly respond on the second question, sorry, I missed it, regarding resistance. And I think I've said it before, including in this venue, that there is no question that the Palestinians have the right to resist under international law, like all people who are oppressed and who cannot enjoy the right of self-determination. The right to resist is to a people what the right to self-defense is to a state. And in the same way, it has limits. So it cannot, neither can touch civilian life. Civilian life is sacred and should always be protected. So I think that we should always remind ourselves and respect the fact that October 7 has been an unspeakable tragedy for the Israelis who call that event the worst terrorist attack they've ever suffered. And as I've said before, for me those surely were crimes to the extent they targeted, they hit civilians, and should have been met by justice. This didn't legitimize the attack on the Palestinians, like if they were the nation responsible, because they were not. And again, this should have prompted a reflection on the causes, on the root causes that have led to that horrific day, which is a horrific day both for the Israelis and the Palestinians, I want to underline. Although I think that this is not the day the genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza started. And is it correct that only the Palestinians are denied of this right? No, I don't think so. I think that after 9/11, there is an increasing intolerance for people's claims for self-determination. And again, we are no longer in the decolonization era, where the right to resist was to an extent even celebrated. To an extent, we are in an era where resistance is often seen and labeled as terrorism. This is the reality for the Palestinians and others. Concerning the suspension, so there are different issues there. But what I refer to is Article 6 of the UN Charter, which says that when a member of the United Nations persistently violates the principles contained in the UN Charter, it might be expelled from the organizations, and there should be a decision of the General Assembly upon recommendation of the Security Council. There have been cases where the impasse of the Security Council has been circumvented by a decision of the General Assembly to act, for example, Uniting for Peace. And this might be one opportunity to consider in this case as well. But I would like to take this opportunity to stress that, again, this is not what prompted me to make that recommendation is not the fact that Israel violates international law, full stop. Israel violates international law from its birth, and international law includes UN Security Council resolution and General Assembly resolution Israel has violated, including the UN resolutions that it committed to abide by as a condition to become a member of the General Assembly of the United Nations, and orders and decisions of the International Court of Justice. And again, this year, the escalation of violence and attacks against the United Nations sets a terrible precedent that, if left unpunished, might also encourage other states to resort to the same kind of venomous reactions toward the United Nations, losing all respect for these organizations. And this should not happen. This is why I think it's time to take an exemplar step. Considering why did I mention the lack of empathy? Because I have the fortune or misfortune to always present my reports to the General Assembly after the Commission of Inquiry, which has a team of investigators and so carries out a very thorough work of collection of evidence. And again, for the third time, I heard the member states criticizing the mandate of the Commission, which means they don't even interact with their counterparts in Geneva, who have toned down their criticism toward the Commission and appreciate the work it does, instead of engaging on the substance. And I've heard member states mentioning again October 7th. I understand. I mean, it's not that I criticize that, but like if history started on October 7th, forgetting the 56 years of oppression and the tens of thousands, if not more, Palestinians who had been killed, let alone the 1 million people who had been arbitrarily detained, including many children. So it's a bit preposterous. And the fact that 17,000 children have been killed, and this was not even mentioned, together with the full destruction of Gaza, I mean, it made me realize that, no, life is not worth the same, and Palestinian life is less worth. This is for some member states. This is a fact. And I'm also annoyed by the fact that this issue, which is so sensitive to millions, because, again, the life of the Palestinians, first and foremost, but also the life of the Israelis, for many of them, is hell since last year. And there is this sort of, let's pick a side, attitude in the General Assembly, one side and the other, that, again, it bears testament to the loss of humanity that has penetrated this institution. The comment I made on human rights and the fact that there has been an erosion of the value of human rights in the last 12 months was prompted by the fact that member states who praise themselves as defenders of human rights and sponsors of human rights, including in their international relations, have engaged in forms of repression and cracking down fundamental freedoms of their own citizens. And in Europe, including of Jewish people who are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians for what they were going through. And this is very telling of the bizarre time we live in. But especially when it comes to students who are, in a way, the most powerful, but also they've been the most powerful voice speaking truth to power, but also they're still the most frail part of the society, because they are investing a lot in building their future, and many of them have seen their future undermined, sacrificed for standing for justice. And what kind of message are liberal universities in the liberal West sending to the students? Yes, we can teach human rights from our podiums in universities, but then don't dare fighting to have them becoming a reality for all, because this is not your job. Basically, this is the message that is being sent.
About the third party
third-party responsibility is there is a clear obligation, which is a general principle of international law, law of state responsibility. When there is an international wrongdoing of any sort, violations of international law, human rights law, international humanitarian law, every state has the responsibility not to recognize the legal consequences of the wrongful act and not to engage, not to aid and assist in the commission of the wrongful act, but rather acting to lead to the cessation of the same and ensure reparations. Nothing of this has been done. But now we are also in a context where, as the International Court of Justice has recognized the plausibility of the genocide could be committed already in January, this triggered the application of the Genocide Convention, meaning the obligation to prevent genocide, for which you don't have to wait to have acts of genocide fully completed and a people or a group completely destroyed. You need to act so that genocide doesn't take place. And so an arms embargo was a clear obligation the day after the court has passed, has issued those provisional measures. Instead, the international community has followed Israel on its attack against UNRWA, and so has continued. I mean, member states continue to trade with Israel and to transfer weapons.
Mike Wagenheim with I-24 News. It's been a while since we've last spoken. A couple questions for you. In your report, you have a line in here that says that since its establishment, Israel has treated the occupied people as a hated encumbrance and threat to be eradicated, and you go on listing other items. We'll leave aside the contextual and factual debate about that. Based on that statement, it seems to infer that you believe that Israel has been an occupier since the day of its birth. Is that your position? You said since its establishment, Israel has treated occupied people, et cetera. Are you inferring that Israel has been an occupier since 1948?
Why do you have to infer instead of sticking to what I said?
And I'm asking. That's what's in there.
Let me elaborate.
Okay.
Israel has taken, and I can concede that it has done it with the recognition of the General Assembly, but from a human rights law point of view, and as I take a people-centered approach, I cannot forget it. The creation of the State of Israel has meant the dispossession of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have been kicked out of their homes and never allowed to return. Why so? And does it make it an occupier? It makes of Israel a state who has forcibly displaced a significant part of the native population. And this is the past that has never been addressed. The Palestinians with Israeli citizenship who remained in Israel have been kept for two decades under military rule. And this is why when I say an encumbrance, I was not even referring to them, but as you ask, I mean, this is documented, so it's not debatable, it's history. And since 1967, which is what I'm most interested in because of the mandate I have, Israel has continued these practices, has extended the custodianship system that had been used to take control of all the properties left behind by the Palestinian refugees, but without time limit. So from 1967, I think this is military order 50-58, or one of the early military orders, Israel has been able to seize and acquire all the property left behind by the Palestinians. The 350,000 who were forcibly displaced outside the occupied Palestinian territory in 1967, and the hundreds of thousands who have been kicked out of their homes and lands ever since. So there's been a continuity. So it's not just about what has been happening in the occupied Palestinian territory for the past 57 years is the fact that, unfortunately, there is a continuity with patterns of conduct that had already been enacted in modern-day Israel.
I'm not sure that answers the question, but it will have to suffice. One other question for you, because I know my colleagues want to jump in here. You know about the controversy surrounding your positions and your statements. I'm not going to repeat them here. But you did comment on social media within the past week, and I'm going to read this back. You said, "I'm profoundly committed to human rights for all people. How could I ever be an anti-Semite?" A few days ago, you were supposed to have a briefing with members of Congress. That briefing was canceled. Don't know if the Jewish lobby was behind it or not, but...
Oh, you said Jewish lobby?
Jewish lobby.
Watch out, because it's very anti-Semitic, apparently.
It is. I was...
I didn't use it. You did.
Don't know who you feel was behind it. In any case, you appeared, and your appearance there was sponsored by a group called Code Pink. You appeared in a video with the co-founder of Code Pink. Code Pink, well-documented, shills for some of the world's worst human rights violators. Maduro, Iran, where they appeared with Holocaust deniers, they deny the genocide going on in China of the Uyghur population, completely deny it. How can you say, appearing with a group like that, that you stand and are committed for human rights for all people and are not an anti-Semite? This group is drawn to you, and you happily appear with them while they shill for human rights abusers all over the world and only focus in on Israel.
According to this principle, I shouldn't be asking questions from journalists, for example, unless I check their pedigree. And I explained to you, because I was not at an event hosted by Code Pink. Check your sources, because this is not correct. I was
hosted. That you appeared in a video with the co-founder.
Can I finish?
Sure you can.
I was speaking at an event organized by Buzz Boys and Poets, a venue I've always attended wonderful talks. Then if they have hosted people who have terrible records, I don't know, but I wouldn't feel responsible. And as I was on my way out and looking at the murales, Medea from Code Pink approached me and said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Of course, do you mind being on record?" Of course not. And that is it. Now, do you want to add on the allegations against me because I answer a question to Medea Benjamin, or do I have to check, to do a background check or any person I talk to?
You have no idea who Code Pink is?
Of course.
You have no prior contact with them?
Of course I know who Code Pink is, but I'm not as informed as you are. Thank you for educating me.
That's part of my job as a journalist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Stefano Vaccara, La Voce di New York, Ital Press. I'm sorry because I arrived, I think you had started already a few minutes, so I don't know if you talked about it, but I heard about when you were talking about the Israeli government accusing you to be anti-Semitist, but here our anti-Semitism, but did you respond to that tweet that Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield wrote yesterday? She wrote that, "As a UN Special Rapporteur Albanese visits New York, I want to reiterate the U.S. believes she is unfit for a role. The United Nations should not tolerate anti-Semitism from a UN-affiliated official hired to promote human rights." This is the Ambassador of the United States at the United Nations. What's your response to...
I have the same shock that you have looking at how the United States is behaving in this context, in the context of the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza. I'm not surprised that they attack anyone who speaks to the facts that are, frankly, on our watch in Gaza. And they do that so brutally because they feel called out, because it's not that the United States is simply an observer. The United States is being an enabler in what Israel has been doing. So of course they have a conflict of interest in orchestrating attacks against anyone who criticizes Israel. But besides this, I really don't feel comfortable at entertaining any longer discussions concerning the attacks against me, because it's not about me, and I'm not the story. The story is the fact that there are Palestinians who risk to be erased from their land. The questions that journalists should ask, I mean, this is what I would expect. How do you comment on the fact that Israel has passed laws that outlaw UN organization? Because other member states who have even a worse record than Israel could do the same. Human rights record than Israel could do the same. How do I comment the fact that Israel there has been a plan to erase Palestinian presence from northern Gaza, and the fact that Israel is freely talking about going back to Gaza and reoccupy Gaza, while the International Court of Justice has recognized that the occupation is illegal and must go unequivocally and totally? This is what I want to talk about, because if we keep on entertaining discussions on is she an anti-Semite or not, I'm sorry. Think what you want of me. I will do my job until I have this mandate, and that is it.
Just a quick follow-up. Just to say that this is about what you have to cover, in the sense if I understood what you're saying, basically, don't focus on me, focus on what I denounce in my reports and so on. But if I understand that a special rapporteur is effective or could be effective if it maintains if appears, not only his, but appears neutral, or they can, you know, talk to both sides. So for now, we're seeing that U.S. ambassador, and it's a personal tweet, I mean, it's a tweet that's attacking you. So my simple question, and it's not a personal question, it's about your work as a rapporteur.
Yeah.
In the last, let's say, one year, could you have done something different? Do you think you could have done something different to maintain your, to be more effective in be able to talk to both sides?
But you seem to be someone who measures effectiveness in talking to both sides, and I don't even understand who both sides are. What are? So can you be more specific on who are the both sides?
I'm talking as a journalist. I'm not talking as
I know, but you ask me questions.
As a journalist,
I
say that we see, if we do a research, we as a journalist have to quote our source and everything. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately, your name now, when we quote in our article, because according to the report that Albanese wrote, unfortunately, you are considered, not by me, but by what happened in the situation that we have also that, I don't remember Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield do an attack like this for anybody on Twitter. Unfortunately, it's like it doesn't make your work, your reports, what you're denouncing, any more effective.
But this is your opinion. How do you measure effectiveness?
Well,
let's cut it short. First of all, there is an inaccuracy, and I have to be clear about that. And I don't want to put the spot on you, but because and thank you for that. It gives me the opportunity to clarify. But an independent expert of the United Nations with a human rights monitoring mandate is not requested to be neutral. It's requested to be impartial. It's different. It's different. Tell me how I am partial, because I am the only special rapporteur who has investigated violations of international law committed by Hamas in my second report and the Palestinian Authority. And I've tried to visit the prisons run by the Palestinian Authority, and I was prevented from doing so by the by Israel, and who prevented my visit. And if you look at the terms of reference of my resolution, of the resolution creating this mandate, my mandate obliges me to look at the violations committed by Israel. So when you say talk to both parties. But I understand what you are trying to say. I should maintain a position that allows me to be listened to by all member states. And this is what I've done until March this year. I've had the discussions with everyone. In March, already 30,000 Palestinians had been killed, and it was clear that it was not in the horizon that this would stop. And again, I speak. What do I do? I tell the facts, and I point to the responsibilities of member states. Of course, member states are not pleased with it. So I don't particularly take, I'm not sensitive to the fact that any ambassador criticizes my work. Look at, it seems that there is also some misinformation about the work of Special Rapporteur. I mean, the Special Rapporteur on Iran receives criticism by Iran. The Special Rapporteur on Myanmar receives criticism by Myanmar. What is unique here is that Israel is the only state that it's absolutely protected and cocooned by most of the West, what Craig Mohaiber calls the settler colonial bloc. Yeah, and my mandate is the only one who, in fact, stands looking straight in the face at Western states. So, I take your criticism. Next time, try to be a special rapporteur on the OPT, and maybe you will be more effective than me.
Welcome back, and that was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestine, taking questions during a press conference several days ago in New York City. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Journal Special Worldwide Radio Broadcast for Tuesday, November 5th, 2024. And we've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website, and that is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Pharoah Sanders from a 1972 album entitled Black Unity. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week. Thank you.